Them available as podcasts. So just reviewing, these are the lifestyle classes that we give on Tuesday evenings. And we started last week with a series of shows about the guru. And guru literally means heavy in Sanskrit. It means one who's heavy. A guru, a bona fide guru, does not flatter the disciple. I'm okay, you're okay. A guru basically is one who qualifies the disciple in order to go back to the spiritual world. And the guru gets his or her information from the original guru, which is Krishna or God. And as we talked about last week, in the beginning of creation, Krishna imparted transcendental knowledge to Lord Brahma, the creator of the universe. And this picture, interestingly enough, is Krishna himself when he was on the planet. God descends from time to time, not frequently, not often, but once in a while, once in every day of Lord Brahma, which is 4,300,000 years times 1,000, Krishna comes in his original transcendental form, and he remains on the planet for 125 years, during which he exhibits divine, super excellent pastimes, and the purpose is to attract fallen souls to his enchanting pastimes and to encourage them to rejoin him in the spiritual world. Now, this is a picture of Krishna during his manifest pastimes on the planet 5,300 years ago, and as a child, he himself went to the ashram of a guru. This is Krishna studying under Sandipani Muni as a guru. So God is the source of all knowledge. So why is he studying from a guru? And the answer is he's showing us how important it is to have a guru. It's showing how important it has to have a bona fide spiritual master. Even Lord Jesus Christ underlined this principle by taking his initiation from John the Baptist, taking his baptism from John the Baptist. And so Krishna accepted instruction. Now the difference is that whatever he heard from his guru, he remembered it immediately because he was the source, as the beginning and middle and end of the creation, he was the source of the knowledge which his guru was imparting to him. He imparted it to Lord Brahma, it comes down through disciplic succession throughout ages and ages. And then when Krishna himself descends and enacts his pastimes on the planet as a human being, then he receives the very same knowledge that he originally imparted to Lord Brahma. He receives it from his guru. So no wonder he remembers it after hearing it one time. And the example is given that, water comes from the ocean. The ocean is the source of all water. And the sun beats down on the surface of the ocean, heats it up, and evaporates water, and the water rises, and it becomes clouds, and then it goes over land, and when it reaches mountaintops and all, the atmospheric changes are such that then that water comes back down in the form of rain, it enters into rivers, and then the rivers go back to the ocean. So Krishna is like the ocean of knowledge, you see, and he imparted the knowledge to Lord Brahma. And Lord Brahma is like a benedictory cloud who pours the knowledge out through human society. And it comes down through disciplic succession, just like the water comes from the mountaintops, and then it comes back to the ocean. See? So the knowledge which Krishna is receiving as a student of his disciple is the knowledge which originally was imparted by him. So these are slides that we covered last week. There's ascending knowledge, which is more or less the knowledge of the scientists. They try to, with their senses, assault or assail spiritual bastions, spiritual subject matters, with their limited senses of seeing, tasting, touching, and smelling. But the more perfect way of getting knowledge is not the empirical method, but to receive it from a bona fide source. We've used this example before, that if you were born, your father impregnated your mother, and then he went away, you took your birth, and now you've reached the age of, I don't know what, say 15, 16 years old. A man walks in, you've never seen this man before, and he claims that he's your father. So now how are you going to verify that he's your father? You're going to verify it by the ascending method or by the descending method. You've never seen him, you've never had any pastimes with him, there's nothing even to remember because you've never even interacted. So what are you going to do? You're going to look at him all you want. It's not going to give you the answer. You're going to taste him, bite his ear or something, you know, touch him, hear from him. You can hear all kinds of things, but you don't know whether they're the truth or they're not. So that would be likened to the ascending form of knowledge. We just don't have the equipment. We don't have the equipment to get perfect knowledge because our senses are imperfect. Now, if my mother walks into the room, say from another door or something, and says, oh, let me introduce you to your dad, then I haven't been able to verify that personally, nor could I ever verify it personally. But by hearing from an infallible authority on the subject, my mother, my knowledge is perfect. My knowledge is perfect. Now, the bias of modern science is they need to verify everything with their material senses. And that may work to some degree with material items and material action. But it's never going to be the methodology by which we can imbibe spiritual knowledge, because by definition, spirit is beyond the range of matter. So having parted the knowledge in the beginning of creation, the Lord Brahma, that body of knowledge are called the Vedas, V-E-D-S, and they were passed down through the ages, not by written methods, but by hearing. In fact, even to this day, the Sanskrit word for education is Shruti, that by hearing something repetitively, it becomes part of one. Whereas if you simply memorize it, it remains up here. You cram it in today, you forget it tomorrow. But if you hear repeatedly, you've actually got it. It becomes part of you. And I think I mentioned last time, we do a number of dramas here. And there are two ways of learning your lines for a drama. One is to memorize them, to look at the paper and read them back and memorize them, to kind of like exercise your mind, flex your mental muscles. In which case, you can get up there on the day of the drama and you can say those lines perfectly. But when you have to do that drama, 6 months or a year later, you're going to have to then go through the whole, because you'll have literally forgotten everything. But our method is we get it on an MP3 and we listen to it over and over again. Not necessarily exercising our minds or anything, just listening to it attentively, that's all. And what happens is it becomes a part of you. And we've estimated that if you listen to it like a 10 or 12 minute skit, two-man 10 or 12 minute skit, if you listen 40 times, that becomes a part of you. And Jai Krishna and I have done this many times over the years. We have a repertoire, about a dozen two-man skits. And we can do those on a couple of hours' notice. Just listen to it once and we're there. And we can do it perfect because it's become part of us. So, of course, material education, you don't want it to be part of you because it's not spiritually satisfying. It is something you just want to cram in, spew it out for the exams, and then never forget, never remember the rest of your life. But if it's something worthwhile and purifying and elevating, then you don't want to approach it with the memorization technique. You want to approach it more with the repetition method of learning. And when I first joined the Krishna Conscious Movement 40 years ago, that's what I did. I wrote down all this. The verses on memory cards, soka cards, index cards, and I put a plastic sheeting over them. And I would flip through. What I would do would be I'd have 30 cards, 30 verses with the Sanskrit and the English, and I would say each one of them three times a day for 30 days without necessarily trying to memorize them. For the first 15 or 20 days, you'd be wondering whether you wasted your time or not. I mean, you know, I'm not really getting... But then, towards the end of the month, you'd start to be able to say these without even thinking about them, without even looking at the cards. And usually after 30 days, you'd have got 30 verses, you see. So this is the method. The knowledge was passed down from spiritual master to disciple, and it was remembered, and it was only necessary to write it when people's minds and their longevity became weakened, debilitated to the point that unless they wrote it down, they wouldn't remember it. If you can remember something, you don't have to write it down, right? If some beautiful girl tells you her phone number, you don't have to write it down, right? Right? You can remember it, or some handsome boy, right? But if something that you're less in tune to, like a homely person writes down, or then you have to write it down because it's just you're not so much in tune to it. So in this age, people are not attuned to spiritual subject matters. They'll talk about, you know, Chevy 454 engines with dual cams and dual carburetors. You know, they'll talk about APRs. They'll talk about, you know, cyberspace and dot-coms and all those kinds of things with great fluidity. But when it comes to spiritual subject matters, they're kind of like stumble bumps. They're not really interested in that. And so the repetition is helpful. Now, here we get into the serious subject matter of the guru. And I forget where we left off last week. I rather suspect that we got a little further than this. Let's start here. This is the 14th slide. We often say this before we give any talk on Sunday. Om Aganati Marandasya Anganagana Salakya Chaksurun Militam Yena Tajmai Sri Guruvim. I was born in the darkest ignorance, and my spiritual master opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my respectful obeisances unto him. So why do we offer this kind of respect to what would be an ordinary man? And the spiritual master would be the first person to tell you, the bona fide spiritual master would be the first person to tell you, I'm not special. I'm not special, you know. You've got all kinds of counterfeiters, especially in India, who do some mystic tricks and allow their disciples to call them God and call them Bhagavan. You've got any number of Bhagavans in India at any given point in time. And they kind of feed upon this the naivete of the common man. And if they can get on the pedestal and be worshipped, and especially if they can get donations as God, they're willing to exploit those circumstances. But a bona fide spiritual master doesn't necessarily do miracles. His miracle is that he repeats perfectly the message of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. When Prabhupada came to America, one person asked him, Swamiji, you have so many followers, so many young followers that are mad after you, so you must be doing some miracles, you know, producing some little gold or some ash or something like that. And Prabhupada said, the only miracle that I've done is that I've repeated without interpretation the message of Godhead. I've kept it intact and repeated it without adding or subtracting. Like the postman. Postman doesn't take out the letter and add and edit it. He just delivers the letter as it was. So what Krishna spoke to Lord Brahma and what Krishna spoke again to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada just came to America and he repeated that. And because he faithfully repeats that, then he's one in a million. That's very rare. If I tell Jerry a story, Jerry tells Wendy, Wendy tells Ben, Ben tells Prem, and it comes back to me, it's not going to be, it's going to be very distorted. And each person will alter it to put themselves in the best light, you see. But Krishna initiates the knowledge, and he says he's God. And so here, 5,000 years later, the bona fide spiritual master says the same thing, that Krishna is God, the source of light. And because he purveys that light, he's considered to be a representative of the Lord. And someone who repeats perfectly, without a personal agenda, the message of the Lord, is transcendental to these four defects. In so many so-called scientific journals, Time magazine always has a science section. You know, what's the latest discoveries in science? And you read down that, and they quote the scientists, and they say, I think this, or I believe this, or we suspect this, or we hypothesize this, or it might be like this, or it could be like that, or perhaps it could be like that. That means they're researching. It means they don't really know anything. It means they don't really know anything. They're researching. They're looking into it. But they don't really know anything. And if you look at the scientific textbooks that were taught in schools 20 years ago, they're completely different. And 20 years from now, they'll still be completely different. So they say truth is advancing. Truth is advancing. But as long as you say, you know, we have more to learn and more to revise and more to edit, it means you're in darkness. You're basically in darkness. Because if you're in light, everything you see everything clearly. You don't have to speculate and say, might be, could be, might be, maybe. If I'm standing in the new day sun, I can see everything and I can describe everything very specifically. So because they're approaching it from the point of view of material senses, and the senses have four defects, every embodied living being has a tendency to cheat, tendency to be illusion, tendency to make mistakes and imperfect senses. And so that means that we in and of ourselves cannot access perfect knowledge. And as soon as I say, I think, or it might be, or maybe, we know that person is veiled in ignorance. Just as an example is tendency to cheat. Well, again, science is rife with it. There is more evidence to show there's more evidence to show that they were highly evolved. I don't even want to like to use the word evolved. They were highly civilized, highly sophisticated human beings and civilizations in the ancient past. There's more evidence to that effect than to the contrary, but because it's a la mode, it's been a la mode for the last 100 years or so, to believe that everything has progressed from primitive beginnings in a linear fashion to our present civilized state, because that's been generally accepted as a la mode. The evidence, scientific, archaeological evidence for higher, more advanced civilizations in the past has been suppressed. Our Michael Cremo, he wrote a book called Forbidden Archaeology. It's like, it's this big. And he says this is just a sample. All the discoveries which were literally wiped out, which were literally eradicated, and the scientists who discovered them were discredited and run out of the system on tar and feather. So he wrote this book called Forbidden Archaeology, and now he's known, now the scientists call him the Forbidden Archaeologist. Because they're trying to discredit him. But all he's doing is just bringing up all this counter evidence to the generally accepted theory of evolution. You know. And as far as primitive man, you know, you say, well, we found this skull of a Neanderthal, which is so many tens of thousands of years old. But you can find the same people with the same skeletal structure and the same Neanderthal people walking the streets of New York City today. You know. And you could also find tens of thousands of years ago coexisting with the Neanderthal, very, very sophisticated civilized cultures. So that's cheating. Illusion, main illusion from which we suffer is we think we're these bodies. We call ourselves black or white or Christian or Hindu based on this body. But actually, we are the driver within the body. We're not the body itself. I've said this before. A friend has never seen his friend. A wife has never seen her husband. A hunter has never seen her wife. Parents have never seen their children. How can I say that? They've seen their bodies. They've seen their bodies, but they haven't seen the driver within the body. And so that's our chief illusion from which we suffer. And then we make mistakes. John F. Kennedy made a mistake that day in Dallas. Shouldn't have gone in that motorcade. Gandhi was told the morning he used to go to the Birla temple and give a darshan. He used to sit in. Every evening, it was very predictable in Delhi. He would go to the Birla temple and sit in public view. And the security people had word of an assassination plot, and it was coming down that night. And they said, "You should not go to the Birla Mandir." But he insisted, "It's my habit. I'll go, whatever may happen." So he got shot. He got killed. Our tendency to make mistakes and imperfect senses. I can't see. In the darkness, I can't see beyond these lights here. If I close my eyes, I can't see. So how am I going to see God? I can't even see my wife. I can't even see my dog. I can't see my bird. So how am I going to see God? I just don't have the equipment. But there's a different kind of seeing, and it's seen with the help of the scripture and seen with the help of the great saints and sages. And that's what the guru does. And I know we didn't do this verse next week, so now we're on new territory here. Who can be a guru? Now, there's this prejudice in India that the caste consciousness, that you have to be born in a Brahminical, a higher class family, in order to act as a Brahmin. And if you're not born in that family, then you're disenfranchised as far as spiritual knowledge is concerned. But here this verse is, Kiba vipra kiba nyasi sudra keni haya, ye krishna tattva veti se guru haya. If you're a professor in the university, and you can articulate law, or you can articulate geometry, or you can articulate European history, or you can articulate, you know, narrative literature of the Middle Ages. Who cares what your birth is? Who cares what your background is? Point is that you're full, you're laden, like a rain cloud is laden with water, you're laden with knowledge. So who cares where you were born or how you got the knowledge? The point is you've got the goods. You can give the knowledge. And that's what it's about. It's not about some mystical birthright, you know, that you pass down seminally from generation to generation. It's got nothing to do with it, you know. I mean, look at the papacy. Look at the Catholic popes. You know, some of the popes were homosexuals. Some of them had illegitimate children. Some of those illegitimate children became popes themselves. And they were just as great a debauchees as their parents. So it has nothing to do with seminal succession, but it has everything to do with transmission of knowledge. So anyone who knows the science of Krishna, who can deliver God and God consciousness, that person is a guru. So the English translation, which you've already read, no doubt, it does not matter whether a person is a learned scholar in Vedic wisdom or is born in a lower family or is in the renounced order of life. If he is master in the science of Krishna, he is the perfect and bona fide spiritual master. So the transmission of knowledge is what's at stake here. Nothing to do with lineage or birthright. In the beginning, now this is a very famous verse. Ado shada tato sadasang tato bhajana tato narda navitisha tata shaktish tata bhavastata pirmabhiranchati. And this is the translation. This is by Rupa Goswami in his Nectar of Devotion, or Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. In the beginning, one must have a preliminary desire for spiritual realization. If you don't have a desire for spiritual realization, then forget about it. You know, there's no one's going to be able to get through to you. It's said that it's harder to wake up someone who's pretending to be asleep than someone who's actually asleep. There are many innocent people, and they may be being misled. They may be doing all kinds of karmically negative activities. But they're not averse to enlightenment. They're not averse to instruction. And so they can be influenced. I mean, Prabhupada came to America in 1965, and look at the things that were popular then. LSD, marijuana, free love, you name it. And even though the young people were engaged in all these sinful activities, they weren't averse to spiritual realization. In fact, many of them were trying to get spiritual through these things. And when Prabhupada came and said, you can't get spiritual realization through material indulgences, you have to use spiritual means to get spiritual realization, they listened to him. Not everyone, of course, but enough that he initiated 5,000 disciples. And to be his initiated disciple, you had to give up illicit sex, intoxication, eating of meat, and gambling. And so many did. And it means that they weren't averse to spiritual life. So in the beginning, you have to have a desire. If you're averse, then you know, you're not going to get through. So this will bring one to the stage of trying to associate with persons who are spiritually elevated. So then you'll naturally hear those Hare Krishnas and they're chanting and having festivals and all. So let me go and see what this is all about. In the next stage, one becomes initiated by an elevated spiritual master. When one becomes attached to the association of spiritually minded people, and one no longer has a taste for associating with people that are talking about worldly affairs, then one desires at some point to formalize one's association in a spiritual society, and one may approach a bona fide spiritual master for initiation and personal instruction. So then it says, under his instruction, the neophyte devotee begins the process of devotional service. Now, Prabhupada, before he left, he wrote like 100 books. And I was there one time in Berkeley, California, and he was seated on the seat, and there were some press people there. And they said, Swamiji, what will happen to your movement when you die? And he immediately responded, I will never die. I will live forever in my books. So he intended future generations to get his association through the books. And he said, I've put everything in my books. Anything that Prabhupada said verbally in a public audience, the same things could be found in his books. By execution of devotional service under the guidance of the spiritual master, one becomes free from all material attachment, attains steadiness and self-realization, and acquires a taste for hearing about the absolute personality of God in Sri Krishna. This taste for hearing, there are symptoms for people that have a strong taste. One is they get goosebumps on their body at hearing the names of Krishna or any bona fide name of God. Their hair stands on end. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, tears flow from his eyes like torrents of rain. And he is feeling one moment in separation from the Lord, like as if it was 12 years. So that intense hankering to rejoin with the Lord is a symptom of a taste for hearing about the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The taste leads one further forward to attachment for Krishna consciousness, which is matured in bhava. And bhava is a name for ecstasy. It's the ecstatic symptoms of love of God. And then that is followed quickly by prema, which is the highest perfectional stage of life. So here are different levels of consciousness here in this little graph here. And I'm not sure how well you can read it. Actually, you can read it better than I can. On the lowest level, there are the five senses, the indriyana, seeing, touching, tasting, smelling. And they're attached to the body. Now on the subtle level, this is like shirt and coat. Like we can relate to this in a Utah winter. Most of us don't go outside without a coat. And then we have a shirt on underneath it. And then there's us inside. And it's interesting too, because in India, when you go to the temples, especially in South India, they're always breaking coconuts. There's a guy who's selling coconuts, and they give them to the priest, and they break them. They'll break hundreds of coconuts. I wish they could put them to some better use, you know, like use them. But the symbolism is that you have the outer shell, the outer husk of the coconut, which represents the body and the senses. Then you have the inner white sort of pulp, which represents the shirt, you might say, the coat, the outer coat and the shirt. And these are the subtle aspects, the subtle parts of the body, affection, conscience, reason, memory, and imagination. And then you have the juice, the milk, or the water of the coconut, and that represents the soul. So as soon as you break the coconut, then the water is no longer contained and it escapes. So once one submerges oneself, manasa kamanagira, one's mind, one's body, one's words, are all engaged in the service of the Lord according to the directions of a bona fide saintly spiritual master, then liberation is imminent. Liberation is going to be awarded to that soul in the very, very near future. And we'll stop today, because we're just about ready to do yoga class, with this verse. If you want to understand the Bhagavad Gita spoken by Krishna, just as Lord Krishna originally spoke pure and transcendental knowledge to Lord Brahma, he again spoke the same knowledge to Arjuna 5,000 years ago. And the reason that he spoke it to Arjuna is he said that in due course of time, in spite of all the efforts and purity of the great saints and sages, anything atrophies in due course of time. So he said, the knowledge as I spoke to Lord Brahma has become little less. So now I'm speaking it again to you, Arjuna. I'm re-imparting it, giving a little another shot into human society. And he says, if you want to learn the truth, Bhagavad Gita means the song of God. It's the highest truth spoken directly by the Lord himself, right from his mouth. The best way to learn this truth is to approach someone who's following. Someone who's following the line of the civic succession, who's following his guru, who's following his guru, who's following his guru, who's following his guru, who's ultimately following Lord. Inquire from him submissively. You need to ask questions of the guru. You need to clear up these kinds of matters. But asking questions and receiving answers is not as important as the fact that once you become attached to a genuinely saintly person, once you have a taste for that kind of association, once you lose your taste for worldly associations, it's not that the questions go away. You'll always have questions. I don't have all of my questions answered after 40 years. And it's not really about questions answered. You know, a lot of times you have a question, you get the question answered. It doesn't really increase your faith. You just got the question answered, you know. And if you have your heels dug in and you get the answer to a question, a lot of times it'll just give you ammunition why you want to defer surrender and commitment. You know, it just means you got more information. Doesn't mean that you've gotten necessarily transformation. So what happens when we associate with spiritually minded persons, and especially someone who's totally engaged in the service of the Lord according to the direction of his spiritual man, is the questions don't go away, the questions just shrink. So of these different aspects, inquire and render service, the rendering service is more important. Because in the rendering of service, either the questions get answered themselves, or the questions become less of an obstacle. They just shrink in importance. The self-realized souls can impart knowledge unto you because they have seen the truth. That's in the 4th chapter, 34th verse of the Bhagavad Gita. And it's the prescription for understanding the Bhagavad Gita. There may be many medicines in the apothecary shop, and they're all good for certain purposes. But every one of them has its application written on the bottle. And it also has the dosages that one should take and the regularity with which one should take them. So if one wants to understand the Bhagavad Gita, one should take the prescription from the person who spoke the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna, And Krishna's prescription for understanding the Bhagavad Gita is try to understand the Bhagavad Gita by inquiring about it from a bona fide spiritual master and simultaneously rendering service unto him. So we'll stop there.